Blog Talk Radio.
My calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're gonna see some serious sh.
Dear Frodo, you asked me once if I had told you everything there was to know about my adventures. Well, I can honestly say I have told you the truth. I may not have told you all of it.
Bilbo Baggins, I'm looking for someone to share in an adventure.
I can't just go running off into the blue. I am a Baggins.
Wait!
Of Baggins.
Bilbo, allow me to introduce Feely, Keely, Oin, Loin, Darlin, Barlin,
Biffa, Bofa, Bompa,
Dory, Nori, Ori, and the leader of our company, Thorin Oakenshield.
Far over the misty mountains cold, to dungeons deep and caverns old. The pines were roaring on the high, the winds were moaning in the night, the fire was red, it flames spread, the trees like torches.
I cannot guarantee his safety.
Understood.
Nor will I be responsible for his fate.
You'll have a tale or two to tell when you come back.
Can you promise that I will come back?
No. And if you do, you will not be the same.
My name is Bilbo Baggins.
Baggins. What is a Baggins's price?
What's up, everybody? I'm pretty sure that no matter what I say right here, it won't be as grand as that trailer. It is, of course, Sunday night at 7:30, or 7 o'clock. I don't even know what time we're on. We've been on for 4 years, and I don't even remember what time. You know, I usually cut down the trailers, if I remember to, at least a little bit, so they're, because some of them can be very long if you just listen to them, but I swear to you, I listened to that trailer 3 times to try and find places I can cut, and there was nothing I could take out. It's just, it's amazing, just like, oh, I guess I'm spoiling my review for the movie, but we'll get to that in a couple minutes. We have The Hobbit to talk to you tonight about. Also, we'll be talking about Hyde Park on Hudson, the Bill Murray flick where he portrays FDR, and we'll be talking to the director of that movie. Roger, is it Michelle?
I think it's Roger Mitchell.
I think so.
I talked to the guy, and I don't even know. That's pretty sad, but I think it's
well,
Mitchell.
I'll have to check that because I'll have to do some editing on the show titles and things like that. So, but yeah, big week with as far as that goes. I say that every week, but it's always a big week here, so you guys will have to deal with that. What's going on with you, man? How you got Christmas shopping done? Everything all prepared?
Everything's done. I'm ready to go for the holidays. I was looking ahead, though, and I was like, I don't know how I'm going to keep up. There's so many movies coming out the next 2 weeks.
Yeah,
it's like, and basically what the situation is I'll be leaving for about 5 days next weekend, so I won't be doing much writing or doing anything like that. So I've got about 2 weeks worth of reviews to catch up on in about 4 or 5 days. So I'm not gonna be the happiest camper all next week. I'm going to be pretty annoyed, but that's just kind of how it goes. I'm used to it. It was like that last year. It's just something to deal with.
If I know you, you've already got Django written. You've got already got Leibniz.
No, you don't know me at all then, because I don't I don't do anything until the last minute. It's just, one of my things. I was like that in school. I do my best work under pressure, and that's kind of just how I am. I put all this burden on myself.
Travis, there? It looks like we lost Travis. He'll be back in a second. But I can definitely preach to what he's telling there. I myself am a very last-minute guy. The difference with me, though, is for some reason I put everything off to the last minute. But then at the last minute, instead of just doing everything I said I was going to do, I find reasons why I don't have to do what I was going to do or why I shouldn't do what I was going to do. And it ends up not completing a lot of it. So I guess I'm a little bit worse than a last-minute kind of person. But regardless, it is – 1 week prior to Christmas, I believe it's 1 week prior to Christmas, and looks like we've got Travis back.
That's annoying. Yeah, I put all this burden on myself, and then I cut myself off, apparently.
We haven't lost you on air for like a month or two.
Yeah, it looks like it's going to happen now for some reason. I don't know why. I had to go the usual precautions, but apparently that's what's going to happen right now. Hopefully it won't continue. But anyway, no, I always wait to the last second to do everything. So I'm not caught up on anything. I've got everything that's in that coming up in the next 2 weeks. I have to do them all. So you know, I'm going to be busy.
I guess the reason I would have known that is because you are unlike most procrastinators in the fact that you actually do everything that you put off to the last minute. I was just explaining to everybody how I am the same way, except for the fact that the last minute I put so much stuff off that I'm like, well, what do I not absolutely life and death have to do? And that doesn't always work out too well. But, yeah, we got about 1 week to Christmas. I am proud to say that I managed not only to get all my shopping done prior to the 24th, which is usually when it all got done, but it's wrapped and ready to go, and I don't know what to do with myself now.
Yeah, well, I do all my shopping on Amazon, so I let them do all the wrapping and all that crap. So I don't have to worry about it.
Shit, I did like half of my shopping on there. I forgot they had gift wrap options.
Yeah, they gift wrap everything.
I didn't want to put our buddy Josh Hilton into that kind of position to wrap my presents for me.
Yeah, I know. I forgot he works at Amazon. But, yeah, so let's jump into the movies this week. I know people are waiting on certainly waiting either on a review with Roger or for our reviews of The Hobbit. So let's start with The Hobbit. I think we pretty much have to start with The Hobbit. It is the movie of the week. I hesitate to call it the movie of the month, but it's probably going to be the biggest grossing movie of the month, and certainly once we get to the box office, you'll see just how well it's done already. Yeah. But the Hobbit is obviously it's a prequel to the Lord of the Rings trilogy. It's based on J.R. Tolkien's novel. I believe his first or one of his first.
Yeah, it was his first, I believe.
Right, and it was written. It was written simply, more of a children's story than the Lord of the Rings movies were. So it was always a little strange that Peter Jackson's goal was to – well, Peter Jackson ultimately extended it to three movies, making it a brand new trilogy. It was initially going to be two movies directed by Guillermo del Toro. Well, Jackson took over, expanded it by another film, so now we have a trilogy. And I guess the big concern for a lot of people was that it would be stretched a little thin compared to the other Lord of the Rings movies. I didn't have that issue really with it. The story involves Bilbo Baggins, initially played by Ian Holm, reprising his role from the other movies. And then once they go back in time a little bit, played by Martin Freeman, he's approached by Gandalf to go on his first journey, teaming with a bunch of dwarves who are looking.
Oh, he is not going to be happy now. Travis will be back in just a second. But yeah, so in The Hobbit, as Travis said, it's a prequel, the first book to be written. Now the fourth movie that will turn into the second series, the second trilogy, The Hobbit on an Unexpected Journey. But where Travis left off is that Bilbo jumps into an adventure that Gandalf asks him to go on with quite a bit of convincing. He doesn't want to go at first. And then next thing he knows, all these dwarves are showing up at his doorstep. Now, one bit we missed in the very, very beginning is that The reason these dwarves are there is that
I'm going to reboot after we finish this review. So
okay, that's cool. We got 13-minute interview, so you guys planned on to do that.
No, I'm gonna reboot after this. I don't know where you left off at, unless you want me to continue on.
I was just explaining why the dwarves were there in the first place at Frodo's or Bilbo's house.
They lost their home to the dragon Smaug, who took over the Lonely Mountain, and now they're on a journey to get it back. Led by Thorin Oakenshield, who's part of the royal line of the dwarves. Mm. He's leading their party. And that's essentially the plot. This is how it's going to go for three movies, with them trying to get to the Lonely Mountain and take back the dwarves' realm. I did not have the issues with this movie that a lot of people did. I did not feel it was stretched thin. I enjoyed the 48 frames per second frame rate that Peter Jackson used. I will admit that it took some getting used to.
Now, is that I've never known exactly what the, like, when people get when the LED TVs came out and it has that soap opera-ish look, is that what the 48 frames per second is?
I don't know if I got the technical expertise to be able to describe something like that. But the look of it was more, at first it kind of reminded me of a video game cutscene. And I was like, wow, this is the greatest video game I've ever seen for a while. And then your eyes get used to it, and it just looks crisp. You know, it just looks crisp and clear. So I didn't have a problem with it. It was a little jerky at times, you know, during some of the faster sequences, but it didn't bother me.
Yeah, the only place I saw, just to interject real quick, the only place I saw mm-hmm. that I could really understand, you know, there was a big, I don't know if it's controversy, but people were talking about it, people getting sick while they were watching this movie. And I can certainly see how somebody with motion sickness could get sick during the goblin sequence, where it is very clear, and the thing is, the way your brain works with stuff like that is if your peripheral vision can focus on something else, it doesn't get dizzy. But the screen is so big, and it's moving so quickly, so clearly in 3D, with these quick cut shots everywhere. It's I can see how somebody it didn't bother me, but I could see how somebody could get sick watching it.
Right. No, I can see it. I think if I took my wife, she probably would have gotten sick off it, probably. But she has.
Hey, she doesn't like that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, not normally. So I probably would have done the same thing to her. But I didn't have issues with it after a few minutes. Thought it looked great. And unlike many, I did not feel that the movie lagged. I thought it was actually, I thought there was less of the just walking and walking that we saw in the other three movies. I know that was one of people's biggest complaints about the other movies, as much as they loved them, was that there was just so much of just them walking, you know? And when they weren't walking, it was trees walking, you know? It was just always something was just walking. I didn't feel like that was an issue here. I never felt like there was a time where it really dragged, except for maybe the first, like, 30, 40 minutes when we're in the Shire. And we're dealing with Bilbo, meeting the dwarves and all that stuff, and the setup to the journey I thought was a little slow, but once it got beyond that, I did not have issues. I thought it jumped pretty well from the goblin realm to the elven kingdom to some of their fights with the
he's definitely not gonna be happy when this is done. Travis was talking about the way it moved and how nice it flowed, you know, and it really did. There wasn't a lot of, I mean, the one way you can definitely tell that there wasn't a lot of the same walking for the sake of walking type deals is, if you remember in Lord of the Rings, it seemed like every 10 minutes, but every other scene was interjected with a long shot, like a shot from far away of them walking through the mountains or through the fields or whatever, and you do get one of those shots in here, and they're gorgeous shots. Just in the Lord of the Rings, it kind of pointed out that they were basically going on a very long hike, and that was about the gist of it, with fights in the middle. But in this one, you only have one of those scenes that really shows, you know, them actually walking down down the path, and there was, I didn't even really have a problem with the Shire scenes. I thought that they were well done. And it was really cool because it goes back in time, and I'm pretty sure, I would guess, if I had to guess, I would say that most of the actors from the Shire and most of the actors in the movie that aren't main characters or require a professional actor are local New Zealanders. And thanks to that, you got a lot of the same people playing the same roles as in Lord of the Rings. Like in the Shire, for instance, the two that I always recognize and most people probably remember is that there's a portly man and his old wife, and they always kind of give dirty looks to anybody walking by, You get to see younger versions of those two, and it gives a nice sense of familiarity. That being said, the stuff in the Shire would have been very boring to me had it not been for the dwarves. You know, everybody likes Gimli from the first trilogy, but you know, they all walk in, and it kind of gets almost to a point where it's almost too silly. Like, it doesn't – seems more like a circus than a fantasy epic. But once you get past that little bit, it really starts to be a lot of fun. I mean, they come in, and they just take over Bilbo's house, basically, and they're eating all his food. And he's too polite to say, get the hell out, but at the same time, he's freaking out because everything's going all over the place. And then when dinner's all over, they go to clean up the dishes, and they start throwing them. Of course, Bilbo's freaking out, but – they have this dwarfish ability, I guess it is, to knock stuff all over the place, but catch it and move it. And it's just, it's a really neat like circus act of putting everything away. That kind of gives a little lecture to it. And the other scene in the Shire that was amazing, you heard in the trailer when you had the voices singing that very powerful Lonely Mountain song, and that is just so well done in the movie that it's hard to take your eyes away from it. That little sequence right there, that song really, surprised the hell out of me, because I loved the theme from the first Lord of the Rings, like the main motivational battle theme that you'd hear. Unfortunately, I don't have a clip for it up, but I thought that was great, and actually I downloaded an MP3 of the soundtrack, and listened to it. I was kind of disappointed, because it's actually in the score, it's only like 10 seconds of that sound, but then it goes on to like slower stuff, but I thought that was one place that The Hobbit really jumped over Lord of the Rings was the score. The music is just, it's if what you're seeing on screen doesn't make your hair stand on edge, then certainly the score will get you there. Cause it's just short of amazing. Actually not even short of amazing. I'd say it's plain and simply is amazing. And you know, there's a lot for everybody in this. I thought it was very different than The Lord of the Rings. But at the same time, very much like The Lord of the Rings. It had enough different where if you weren't a fan, you could still give it a try, and you'll most likely like it. But there's enough stuff that's the same that old fans aren't going to be disappointed. The action is kind of, I don't want to say few and far between, because there's certainly a lot of action in the movie. But the thing that makes a difference in this film is that the filler between the action, what some people call story, I call filler because I'm an action junkie, is actually very watchable. It gives you a lot of great stuff in there. And as far as it feeling stretched out, you know, and that was one of my main concerns with this movie, because it is just one book, as The Lord of the Rings actually is three books. That's three movies. So when you're taking one movie and stretching it out to three, when you've seen three books in three movies, your first instinct, obviously, is that it's going to have a lot of filler. It's going to be really thin, and they're just doing it for the sake of money. But when you watch this movie, it becomes completely apparent that they almost could have done it into six movies and had six full movies. There is not one bit of this that feels stretched out. Everything that's in there, I was actually surprised at everything we got in this. And then my wife, who's a huge fan of the book, The Hobbit, and the movies, Lord of the Rings, and the books, everything Tolkien she loves, I asked her, I said, you know, I was like, I really didn't know how they were going to pull two more movies out of this one book. And apparently where this film ends, and you'll see what I mean, it seems like they could easily do another movie, but a third movie, I don't know how they would do that. But apparently where they get in this book is actually about a third of the way, I mean, in the movie, it's about a third of the way through the book. So they managed to have – and they really could have made a longer movie out of it, because there's a lot of stuff that you don't get, like the relationship between most of the dwarves, like the two twins, Keeley and Feely. Like, you get a sense of how close they are just from this one scene on a rock face. But other than knowing their names, Ron, you really don't get much. So they could have filled it with a lot more even. And I think, you know, it was pretty amazing that they were able to get – as much on screen and still have plenty, plenty, plenty of story for the next two movies. I definitely don't see the stretched out that people are saying.
No, I don't think they stretched out much of it either. The thing is, he padded out a good deal of it, because what Tolkien's book does, it skips over a lot. Gandalf disappears for long stretches of the book. Certain scenes, like the scenes with the giant, giant trolls and things like that, a lot of those things are skipped over. The whole thing with the necromancer, that a lot of that stuff is kind of glossed over, and then Tolkien kind of follows it up later on in other stories, but he doesn't really deal with it in The Hobbit, and Jackson is kind of pulling from all those other sources to kind of pad things out a little bit. There are still a couple of times where I don't think where I can sense him like kind of squeezing some stuff in, mm-hmm. kind of stretch things a bit. But I didn't think it was as egregious as a lot of other people did. I actually found this journey to be quite exciting once it got going. And I think a lot of the reason why is because I was really into Bilbo Baggins as a hero. Mm-hmm. More so than I am Frodo. Frodo was like my least favorite character of the Lord of the Rings movies.
Yeah,
I don't find him all that interesting. I know he's got this great burden to carry, but he's not necessarily interesting on his own. Like, I don't want to follow him on his own without that burden. You know, I feel differently about Bilbo, and I think he's interesting regardless. I think he's interesting throughout the entire movie. And that's even with his main purpose being there, kind of a mystery. And maybe that's the reason why I found him so interesting. It's because he does have a mystery. Now, we do get a clear-cut purpose for him near the end of the movie. But by then, I was already invested. I already liked him. And that just made me love him even more.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because now that you mentioned it, I hadn't really given much thought to how much – I think for a lot of people, the Sam and Frodo sections of Lord of the Rings are among the most skippable parts of the movie.
Right.
And I think what it all boils down to is the exact opposite motivation for Frodo and for Bilbo. Frodo starts out wanting nothing more than go on an adventure and live life, but he gets out there and now he's complaining about the adventure. He's like, oh, it's so hard, it's too hard. Where Bilbo is the exact opposite, where he doesn't want to do it. He's like, I'm fine with my life, I just want to go back and wake up in my warm bed. And then when he goes out, he starts to like it. And there's nothing worse than hearing somebody always want something, and then when they get it, they bitch about it. And right. I think that's just a human thing that we don't like that, and that's why Bilbo is so much more likable. That and Martin Freeman is just plain awesome in it. I mean, I thought his character was so good. I had seen him he's one of those British actors that you see in pretty much everything that comes out of Britain. I think he may have been the only British actor working today that wasn't in one of the Harry Potter movies, but you'll know he's played the lead in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. He was in the movie Love Actually, which is amazing. You need to watch that right now if you are a fan of Christmas and Christmas movies. He's been in a lot of stuff, and you know it's hard to see somebody and say he's going to be a good Bilbo Baggins, especially where your main source is either the old guy from The Lord of the Rings or the cartoon from the late 70s. But I thought Martin Freeman was just perfect. I mean,
he's so good. He's so likable here. And that scene with him and Gollum together is just such a fantastic moment. And he's a big part of the reason why. He's very curious and mischievous. And it's just a fantastic scene watching them go back and forth. Andy Serkis, of course, is fantastic doing his performance capture thing. I just really had a lot of fun with this movie, and the last 20 minutes or so made me more excited for the next two movies than I thought I would be. I was not somebody who was really interested in seeing The Hobbit by Peter Jackson because I knew what I was in for. But once I saw it, you know, it felt comfortable. You know, you realize just how much you kind of missed Middle Earth. You know what I mean?
Yep.
We spent 10 hours with these movies all those years ago, and you kind of wanted – it felt really comfortable to have it back in my life again. So, I mean, for me, this was a 4 out of 5. I really did enjoy The Hobbit quite a bit.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned all those years ago because I didn't realize – until I was literally just doing something today. Because I had seen this on I was looking on demand for Lord of the Rings Fellowship, and I saw Return of the King. It said 2003. I was like, oh, that must be like counting it all by Fellowship. I didn't realize that Return of the King, the last movie, actually came out back in 2003. I didn't realize it had been a decade since the last Lord of the Rings movie came out. It seems crazy to me. But, you know, the only gripes I had that I could bring forward about this movie are – you know, one thing that Peter Jackson, I don't care if it's in the book and it makes all the sense in the world, it's one thing that he could have listened to the fans and taken out or adjusted to make more sense, and another thing that he could have just taken out completely, and that's the thing that he could have made more sense of was the damn Eagles showing up again. I mean, that was...
What's wrong with that? I like the Eagles.
It's just, I know, but I could almost give it a pass if he did just one line about why these Eagles can't show up whenever he needs them. They only seem to show up and take the points so far.
They do. No, I know, but show up exactly when he needs them. That's why
I'm saying why? Why does he wait until then? Why not call him from the Shire and just fly right to the mountain and take care of business? It's the same thing at the end of the Lord of the Rings where they pick Sam and Frodo up and everybody's like, wait a second, why didn't they just fly those damn Eagles all the way there in the first place? And I know it's a thing, but it's just one of those things that I wish you.
I think yes, but that's part of the mystery of Gandalf, though. You also have to understand that Gandalf, he kind of wants this adventure too, and part of the he kind of knows this adventure is going to change Bilbo.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of there are a lot of things they need to do. I guess you can't just sit there and call the Eagles to take you everywhere, but the journey is the thing. The journey is the thing for him. If I look at it from that perspective, then it doesn't bother me so much that he calls them only when they're in dire straits. It doesn't bug me so much.
Yeah, I get that, and I can vibe with that. But I just wish that he would have taken some of my second complaint and put it into this one. It would work better. Just somebody having an offhand joke, like when they get down and they look over, there's a mountain, and somebody just goes, well, "Why'd they drop us here instead of all the way down there?" You know, and just to show that they recognize it, that we're not just supposed to believe it, would have been good. But that brings me to my second thing is the humor. It was a very funny movie. It was very good at when it wanted to be funny, but there were certain times, one glaring time that really took me out of the scene horribly, where it was almost like Airplane parody style humor when the Goblin King fight is going on and the Goblin King is slain. He kind of looks up and goes, "Well, that'll do it," and then just falls over dead. I was like, that doesn't fit with anything that's queer. It just seemed weird. But if that's the only two complaints that I can drive up from this whole movie, that's pretty damn good because I'm really digging there. And the one last thing that I really, really enjoyed about it is, you know, with a prequel of a very famous series, the director is going to be fighting himself left and right not to make just, silly kind of inclusions of characters we love from the old ones. See any one of the Star Wars prequels for that, you know, that you have now Darth Vader's built 3PO just because we have to have 3PO in all of them. But I thought Jackson did a great job, and maybe it's the book, maybe it's Jackson. I know the Frodo inclusion in the beginning of the movie was not in the book, so that's an ad of Jackson. But I thought the way he did all that stuff, so you could see all these characters that you knew and that were familiar, and they weren't, say for Frodo, they weren't all main characters. It was just like people that were in the movie that you would recognize, and they were all brought in such an organic way, and it wasn't like, hey, look who's here, remember this guy? You know, it was just very well done in that sense to give the longtime fans something, but at the same time, not beat them over the head with it. All in all, The Hobbit gets a 4.5 out of 5 for me. Really just short of perfect film in my mind. And I will say that The Lonely Mountain has now taken top seed over Conan. If you guys forget, here's Conan. Okay, and now here's The Lonely Mountain. And that's, okay, I was just playing the differences between how awesome Conan is and how much more awesome Lonely Mountain is, because that is now taking my top seed. Every time that plays in this movie, it is amazing. It is just motivating. It's awesome. 4.5 out of 5. I don't think there's any reason you shouldn't go see The Hobbit. Like we said, just remember the motion sickness thing is kind of a thing. Just don't see it in 3D. That's all you have to worry about. If you have motion sickness, don't see it in 3D. Other than that, I don't really think it's added anything by 3D in this one. But you know, see it how you want it.
I didn't see it in 3D. So I saw it in the. I don't think it was in 3D.
You saw it at MPAA, right?
No. I didn't see that at the MPAA. We saw it at a gallery. It was in the 48 frames, but I don't remember it being in 3D. I mean, it doesn't really matter. Anyway, you gave it a 4.5 out of 5. I gave it a 4 out of 5. I think we both love The Hobbit, obviously. Let's move on to Hyde Park on Hudson, because we have our interview with Roger Mitchell that we need to get to also. Hyde Park on Hudson. Hyde Park on Hudson is set in 1939. and it's ostensibly about the relationship between Franklin Delano Roosevelt, played by Bill Murray, and his distant cousin Margaret Suckley, played by Laura Linney. And they have their own illicit affair, one of many that Roosevelt had, apparently. And it kind of takes place during one weekend at Roosevelt's upstate New York residence in Hyde Park, when King George VI and Queen Elizabeth, yes, the same ones from the King's Speech, make their visit to the United States to secure our assistance prior to World War II. So this is a pretty important weekend. And while this is going on, of course, Roosevelt and Suckley are carrying on their little affair right under Eleanor Roosevelt's nose. So this one is a little bit odd for me. I thought this was going to be a more serious movie than it turned out to be. Instead, what I refer to it as is the My Week with Marilyn of political movies. That's kind of what it felt like to me. It was kind of light and frivolous, and I guess I shouldn't be surprised because it's directed by Roger Mitchell, who did like Notting Hill and mm-hmm. Morning Glory and kind of these really frothy films that don't have a whole lot of meat to them. They're just kind of fun and cheery, but don't have a lot of substance. This one tries to juggle a lot. The relationship between Roosevelt and Suckley is barely touched upon, which is weird considering that's the framing device for the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And instead, it focuses a lot more than I expected on Roosevelt and the King, and their kind of buddy-buddy mentor apprentice relationship that they kind of had going on there, which I thought was interesting, but didn't get the time it probably could have gotten. There are a few movies they could have made out of this, mm-hmm. And I don't think they did any of them really successfully. It was kind of disappointing.
Yeah. That's actually we lost Travis for a second again, but yeah, it's really, you know, let's just cut to the interview. Give Travis a couple minutes to get his stuff done there, get himself rebooted. I will cut to the interview now. This is our interview with director Roger Mitchell.
Well, I want to tell you, enjoyed the movie.
Good.
Yeah. What drew you to this story in particular?
Well, it's like a fascinating little footnote of a footnote. Mm. It's taking this tiny, tiny event. One weekend in 1939, the world is 12 weeks away from war. Mm. And this is...
Travis, you there? Okay, yeah, we're gonna roll.
I'm here. Yeah, okay. And I don't know what's going on with my Skype today. It's being a real pain in the butt. So,
do you want to just roll to the interview and we'll come back to the review afterwards?
Yeah, let's do that.
All right. So that little tease is 20 seconds of the interview. You'll get the full thing now. Check it out.
Well, I want to tell you, enjoyed the movie.
Good.
Yeah. What drew you to this story in particular?
Well, it's like a fascinating little footnote of a footnote. Mm. It's taking this tiny, tiny event. One weekend in 1939, the world is 12 weeks away from war. And this is a story about a collision of events where, bizarrely, at the end of it all, a man taking a bite out of a hot dog, you know, changes the way the world is going to work.
Mm-hmm. Did you always had sort of a interest in Roosevelt, or just sort of the event itself?
I've always been interested in the relationships between our countries. And obviously Roosevelt has been pivotal in his dealings with the UK and in the way in which he, against the wishes of his electorate and against the wishes of his own party, mm-hmm. he stood out for supporting the UK in the first 2 years of the war before Pearl Harbor. I mean, that was an extraordinarily sort of brass-necked thing for him to do, and I think it was partly based on realpolitik, but also partly based on a real affection for Europe and for England. And I think without that sort of moral support and material support, I think England would have probably been invaded by Hitler in the early
1940. What is it about Roosevelt in particular remains like one of our most popular presidents,
yeah,
you know, for all this time.
Yeah.
What is it about him in particular that you think people seem to be drawn to?
I think that he exuded confidence. I think he exuded confidence as an individual amongst his inner circle, amongst his government and his cabinet. But I think he also made the country feel confident. I mean, his most famous remark is, you know, all we have to fear is fear itself.
Right.
And I think that in a parallel time of economic disaster and fear and real concern, I think people yearn for that injection of confidence. That economies run on confidence. Economies are a trick of the light. Economies are really constructs of human confidence. And I think that the New Deal was made truly effective by his absolute assurance that things were going to come good in the end.
By the same token, there seems to be a fascination with King George and the Queen, and that whole line in that particular period of time has become so popular, even before the King's Speech, I would say, but certainly after that, it's really gone up. Why do you think that is in particular?
I don't know. I mean, people are still obsessively fascinated with the British royal family, particularly in this country.
Yeah.
I mean, we started making this film a long time before the King's Speech was a twinkle in anyone's eye.
Right.
And when the King's Speech came out, it was like, it was such a massive success that we had to really consider what we should do, whether we should put this one in a cupboard and forget about it.
Mm-hmm.
But we decided to proceed, and I think we made the film in spite of the King's Speech, not because of the King's Speech.
Right.
However, I think there are advantages to us that the King's Speech is out there. I think that it sets the story for our film. It's in a way it's like a brilliant trailer for our film, or a prequel for our film. And I think you're right. People are endlessly fascinated by this one English family, and they can continue to be so. I mean, I think in some ways there's even more fascination here than there is in England.
Right.
Because it's even more kind of like a Disney fantasy here.
Yeah.
To have these ridiculous people who are not elected, who are by some kind of trick of hereditary given these huge responsibilities and huge privileges. And it's very weird.
Do you think a lot of the reason why people seem to be fascinated with both Roosevelt and King George, maybe is their physical limitations to some extent?
Well, that's a very good point. I mean, I think that the key scene, in a way, in the film is where these men inadvertently stumble upon the fact that they're both perceived as being in some way handicapped.
Mm-hmm.
And Roosevelt does something, waves a magic wand over this, and in doing so gives the king such confidence and such belief in himself. I think it's arguable that the polio was the making of FDR. You know, his supreme effort of will to overcome that that difficulty in his life seems to have also triggered supreme abilities in other areas.
Talk to me about that relationship between the two in the movie, because I kind of looked at it as sort of a political buddy comedy in a lot of ways. They're kind of like bros, or getting to know each other in a lot of ways. Is that how you always kind of imagined it playing out?
I didn't really see them as bros so much as father and son. You know, I mean, the king famously had a terrible relationship with his own father, and here he is in the middle of a huge country, a country that's in many ways predisposed to reject him and his wife. He's the kind of rather plain, dull, stuttering one, and everybody wanted his brother to be king in America.
Right.
His brother's like a film star,
and
his brother wanted to marry an American. You know, and so that predisposed people to be even less affectionate towards this king. So he's here with his wife. He's on a kind of secret mission, and he thinks everything's going to go wrong. And he stumbles into this relationship with this incredibly avuncular, supportive, reassuring, clever statesman. And I think that that's in our film anyway, that's that relationship changes the king, you know, gives him, makes him taller and prouder and clearer.
Right. Talk to me about some of your characterizations for some of these characters, because there's the potential for some of them to be portrayed in a negative light. Mm-hmm. Roosevelt is obviously an adulterer. Eleanor, she could have come off as sort of mean-spirited. She could have.
Yeah.
How do you walk that balance? And I guess even to some extent, the Suckley character could as well be seen as portrayed as weak, I guess, some could say.
Yeah.
How do you walk that balance? Because I think you did it very well.
Well, they're all complicated characters. I think that's the thing. You have to accept that they're complicated and that they live complicated lives, and that there's absolutely no intention by any of us who made the film to denigrate or demean great historical characters, you know, characters who still appear on coins.
Right.
That's not the idea of the film at all. But it is the idea to show that they led, you know, rich and difficult and complicated lives with each other, particularly Eleanor and FDR had this very, very modern marriage, if you like, almost like an open marriage. He betrayed her very, very early on in their married life, before he had polio. And she wanted a divorce, and he swore literally on his knees that he would never see this woman again. They agreed to continue their marriage to help his political prospects. Now, from that sort of ruinous disaster, grew one of the most successful, you know, 20th century marriages. You know, I think they lived apart, but they were very, very close to each other, and very, very supportive of each other, and very in love with each other.
Talk to me about Bill Murray, and kind of how the casting came together in general, because I think he plays does a fabulous job here. Talk about me about the decision to pick him.
Yeah, well, I haven't, you know, I didn't, it ended up with me actually figuring that I didn't really want to do the film with anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like a wild idea, oh yeah, he might be good at it. It was suddenly, actually, if I can't get Bill to do it, I'm not going to make the movie. Because I wanted somebody, I mean, there are similarities between the two physically, but I mean, the most important thing for me was this sense of his utter charm, his utter ability to charm the world and to be forgivable and forgiven for his human frailties, if you like. And I think Bill has that mischievous charm in spades. He's hard to get hold of, you know, he's hard to, he doesn't have an agent, so it's tough to make contact with him, but slowly, kind of, I felt I was trying to catch a huge fish with a tiny little hook, but eventually we got there.
How did you get, because I think the film looks very authentic, it was shot in the UK, right? Yeah. How did you work, piece that together?
Meticulous design and planning, lots and lots of study of the actual buildings where the story took place, and we just tried to match everything as perfectly as we possibly could, and we built a lot of the houses that you saw. We built out of wood and cardboard, and
The film's a success. Would you have any further interest in kind of exploring the relationship between the U.S. and the royals?
Well, Richard Nelson, the writer, he's always writing about the relationship between our two countries in a really interesting way. It's an uneasy relationship, but it's very firm. It's like a marriage in itself. It's
right.
A complicated marriage, and I think that that relationship continues to be fascinating, and we're codependent in a way, and you know, everyone in England is sort of devoted to America and yet repulsed by America. We feel you're kind of our big brother, but also we feel kind of under your control, so it's always going to be a fascinating and ambiguous thing.
Holy crap, I've just been reviewing this whole time while I was still on mute. I am so sorry, folks. I guess you didn't hear me the last 2 minutes that I was talking, but I am back now. Little things like not hitting the on-air button will do that to you. But talk about Hyde Park on Hudson. Yeah, it was our interview with Roger Mitchell. Great, great interview. I liked how honest he was about everything, including, you know, the relationship between the U.S. and the U.K. And, you know, the ups and downs of that. But to talk about Hyde Park on Hudson, the movie, you know, Travis kind of hit on one of my big issues with the movie earlier, and that's that there's just too many storylines going. And the way I understood this movie is that it was completely about, like, the plot centered on his relationship with his distant cousin, played by Laura Linney. Margaret Suckley is her name, I'm sorry. And it really didn't just, as Travis said, it really just didn't focus only on that. There was a lot of focus, almost more focus, on the more interesting of the two stories, I thought, and certainly the less disturbing of the two stories, even though I know distant cousin isn't a big deal, especially back in the 30s. But nowadays, any kind of relationship with a relation, as it were, just seems a little weird. But regardless, I think the more interesting story is the one between FDR and King George VI. You know, everybody knows that King George is a very interesting person based on the King's speech. And it's really kind of crazy how much a small, you know, speech impediment can make you that much more interesting. But when you're talking about royalty of England, royalty that we in America still respect just as much as they do over there, not many people are held as high as English royalty. I mean, you just look how much U.S. attention was paid to Kate Middleton and Prince William's marriage and stuff like that. But I think the thing comes in with that stutter, that little malady that he's got, is enough to say, you know, this royal is human, you know, and it really shows it to him. And I think that's very neat. And the reason the relationship with FDR would have been the place to go for this movie is that FDR, as most people know, had polio and was bound basically to a wheelchair for most of his, if not all, I think I'm pretty sure, I don't know when it started, but with his wheelchair, I mean. But he was in a wheelchair for his presidency. But he was never photographed in the wheelchair. He was never gave interviews or talked to people in the wheelchair because he didn't – not because he was embarrassed of it, but because he knew the American people needed to see a strong figure, not just know it was a strong figure. And just the way humans are, if we see somebody in a wheelchair, we're going to think lack of physical ability is equal to lack of ability, period. And I thought there was a great scene in this movie where King George and Franklin Roosevelt are talking, and King George starts to stutter, and they're having kind of not a heated discussion, but it's, you know, kind of a, you know, emotional discussion. They're very into what they're talking about, and he starts to stutter, and he can't stop stuttering, and he finally just stops what he's saying. He says, "Goddamn stutter," and he's so pissed off, and FDR kind of looks at him and, you know, knocks his little leg brace and says, "Goddamn polio." And not in a way that's like, "Hey, what are you complaining about?" But in a way that he's like, "Hey, don't worry about it. You know, I have stuff wrong with me too. You know, nobody's perfect. Just because we're heads of state doesn't mean that we're perfect. It's okay to have a stutter. I'm in a wheelchair. La la." And I thought that was a really touching gesture between two people that you would always assume the most powerful people on the planet are gonna just basically be dicks, for lack of a better term, like, you know, oh, look at this guy, he can't do this. But it was very, it really showed the kind of personalities that brought us through the Great Depression over here in the U.S. and into and through World War II. But I really thought that's where it should have, the focus of the movie should have remained, because to be honest with you, I was just plain bored with the rest of it. I mean, it was nothing interesting about what was going on, because it was one of those things that I'm assuming happens in a lot of superpowered relationships, like the Roosevelts, Eleanor and Franklin, where it's kind of assumed that the husband's going to do what he's going to do. It doesn't mean she's not upset about it, but it also means that there's not a whole lot of drama with it. And I just didn't really see why that was such a thing to talk about. It almost seemed like the only reason to put that in there was to show – I mean, kind of bring FDR down a little bit. I thought that was weird. I mean, the relationship between King George and FDR would have been the way to go the entire time. I was kind of bored with the rest of it. Charles, I was just telling everybody about the – I'm not going to go back completely to it, but my favorite scene in the movie, and what really lets me know that King George and FDR is where the focus should have stayed, is the scene where they're having a discussion privately, and King George starts to stammer a lot, and he just goddamn stutter. And then FDR looks at him and says, "Goddamn polio." I thought that was a very touching, like, scene.
That would have been a great relationship to show, because these are two men who are both
who won't let their physical limitations stop them, you know.
Right.
And it's a very important. It's a through line that we saw in the King's speech with the King George character, how he was able to overcome that.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie would seem to indicate that Roosevelt played at least some part in him overcoming that physical limitation.
Right.
That would have been a great relationship to show. Instead, we get the king and the queen worrying over hot dogs and FDR getting hand jobs in the car. You know,
that was
strange. All that stuff is far less interesting than the dynamic between FDR and King George at such a crucial time in the world. That stuff should have played a much bigger part than it did. I would have preferred to see a focus on that. And I should comment on my interview for a second here, saying that I told him there were a lot more things that I liked about the film than actually were than I actually did. But I was not lying when I said that the film is beautifully shot. It does look great.
Oh yeah.
It looks like an episode of Downton Abbey or something. It looks fantastic. And there are good things. I mean, there are elements of a great film here. Bill Murray is fantastic. I thought the two who played the King and the Queen are very good also. Everybody's fine. I feel like some of the representations of some of the characters was a little lacking. Overall, I ended up giving this a 2.5 out of 5. But there are good things about it. It's just not a movie that I think people are going to be remembering for very long.
No, I mean, this is a movie that, to be completely honest, had the focus stayed where I believe it should have, it could be up to even a 4 out of 5, because everything was there. You know, Bill Murray, the first 20 minutes of the movie, I really thought that it was going to be horrible. But I realized after the movie was over that it's really just my impression of Bill Murray that was taking over, because it seemed to me like it was a funny guy trying to act serious. And, you know, kind of the way you see Murray acting in a Moonrise Kingdom or something like that, where he's not going for jokes like it's Meatballs, but he's still funny even if he's serious. Excuse me, I'm sorry. And that's kind of the way it seemed in this movie at first, but then I realized that it's just how his performance is, and it actually fits really well, and it makes FDR more human. But I just didn't think there was enough drama in the drama of his relationship to warrant any screen time.
Right.
And I think that could have been left out completely for a much better movie.
I agree. All right. So let's talk about how some of these movies did at the box office here. One did awesome. There's really only one movie to be concerned with, because Hyde Park on Hudson doesn't even really register this week at the box office. But The Hobbit, on the other hand, had the highest December opening in history. $84.7 million. We kind of knew this was coming because they had like $37 million on Friday. So it beats out I Am Legend's $77 million. This is obviously it's inflated a little bit, 3D tickets and IMAX and all that stuff, but $84.7 million. I think Warner Brothers, MGM, they're probably pretty happy about that.
They wouldn't be.
Yeah, it tacked on about another $60 million overseas, so it's off to a hot start. We'll see how the rest of it goes, though, because the response to it, at least by critics, has been lukewarm. But audiences gave it an A cinema score, so people who saw it loved it.
Yeah, I don't see what critics that didn't like this are talking about. I honestly didn't read anybody else's, so I can't.
Mm.
I don't know if they're pointing out things that I missed, but it was just such an adventure. I can't see. And I actually had I might have been looking at the wrong thing, but I had the overseas box office at like $160 million.
No, I mean, I had it at $60 million. I had it at $57 million, actually.
I was thinking I should have put foreign market. I put worldwide, so that includes the U.S.
Okay.
I'm dumb. Let's move on.
Coming in second was Rise of the Guardians at $71 million total. The rest of the top 10 is pretty much just stuff that's been around for weeks now. Silver Linings Playbook's number 10, up to $16.9 million. Is the only one that really had any serious movement. Red Dawn at 9, Playing for Keeps at 8. Nothing else really struck, really made much movement. This was all about The Hobbit, and it's $84.7 million. So everything else is almost the same as last week. So
yeah.
Don't worry about anything else. So that's pretty much the top 10 right there for you.
Yeah, the only weird thing I noticed, and we won't stay any time on it, is you usually see movies go down sequentially in the order they debut. Like, what's two? Will next week be three? Will next week be four? But right. Skyfall, Rise of the Guardians, and Lincoln are playing this weird hopscotch with the top three or four positions. If you remember, Skyfall was number one last week. Yeah. And it's number four now. So that's a little bit crazy, but yeah. DVDs this week.
You know it's holiday season. You know it's holiday season because look at that list of DVDs coming out.
Yeah,
it's
there's actually – we have DVDs coming out now. I hope this isn't a regular thing because I like when DVDs just come out one day a week. But we have DVDs Tuesday and Friday. The Tuesday releases are Trouble with the Curve with Clint Eastwood, Justin Timberlake, and Amy Adams.
So disappointing.
Yeah,
such a disappointing movie. I mean, it's ridiculous. I did my I think you saw it. I did my top 10 movies of the year the other day for Examiner, and I threw in a bunch of random categories at the end just off the top of my head. I didn't think about them. I just rattled off a bunch of random categories, and one of them I had in there was a sports movie. I had best sports movie, and I gave it to Backwards. But this is really probably the shittiest movie year for sports movies I've ever encountered.
I didn't even think about it. You said it, but yeah.
It is really shitty. I mean, when I say the best sports movie was Backwards, a movie I don't even really like.
Is that the Vanderbeek really movie?
That was the Vanderbeek movie. I mean, there's no
Dawson
sports movie.
Got the number one sports movie?
Yeah. I mean, it was not even that great of a movie. I think I gave it maybe a 3 out of 5, maybe. And it's not even that good of a movie, but it's better than Trouble with the Curve.
Yeah,
it's better than Playing the Field. I mean, this is just a really bad year for sports movies. Terrible.
Yeah, I'm actually looking at. I know we saw differently on this particular movie, but Goon probably would have got my number one. But
you like Goon.
It's still a very low. I mean, when a surfing movie is one of the only ones coming out that year. Nothing is surfing, but there's really only like 6 or 7. Different sports movies that came out, and that's not even all wide releases. But
Goon, I wanted to rip my eyeballs out.
I thought it was fun. I mean, he was a little bit annoying, but I thought it was fun. Trouble with the Curve, I really hope is not Clint Eastwood's last movie because he seems to be going softer. And for a guy that seemed as hardcore as he was in 1962, in 2009 or whenever Gran Torino came out, he really kind of seems to be softening up, and that's not the Clint Eastwood I want to remember. Total Recall, movie that I think will get a life on DVD. I think it's not great, but it's better than a lot of people gave it credit for. I think that's a rental for this week. I think a lot of people like that just to watch at the house. 10 Years. Do we even talk 10 Years on here?
I believe we did briefly. And I seem to recall Rocky being around. Maybe she was, or maybe she wasn't.
Well, it was a Channing Tatum movie, so she must have been.
Yeah, but I actually pre-ordered 10 Years. Two movies out of this list that I actually ordered were Pitch Perfect, it was in my best of the rest list. Mm-hmm. So it was in the bottom, it was like, I did my top 10, and it was like 11 through 20. Pitch Perfect was in there. Pitch Perfect and 10 Years are the two movies that I pre-ordered. I think they were both a lot of fun. So that's two movies coming out on Tuesday that I think are great. Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Dog Days, is coming out next week. I did not see this one. I was gone. And I'm actually kind of upset by it because I actually enjoyed the first two.
Yeah, it wasn't the best of the three, certainly. But it was good. I at least talked about it because I remember you making fun of me because it is kind of disturbing because his crush, the blonde girl, is starting to look more like a woman. And you're like, wait a second, you know, it's kind of like the Hermione Granger thing, but she's still actually young, so you can't look at her like that. Not that I did. Travis said he did, and I didn't do it.
Right.
It's perfect. I've been getting yelled at. I can't wait till Tuesday because I've been getting yelled at about that since I kept promising my wife I'd take her to it, and more stuff kept coming out, and then it was just not in theaters, and I was like,
it's a really fun film, and I love Anna Kendrick, so, I mean, she's a lot of fun in that movie. Arbitrage comes out on Tuesday. Arbitrage is a fantastic film.
Uh-huh.
Richard Gere, borderline Oscar worthy, I think. I think he probably is Oscar worthy. Whether or not he gets that acclaim, I don't know. But I think he's certainly up there to be nominated for Arbitrage. And I remember when the trailer for this came out, I panned the shit out of it. Because it sounded fucking boring. And I was like, I don't want to watch Richard Gere in a financial world thriller. That sounds fucking terrible to me. And then I was wrong. The movie's great. So that's me eating my words. I was wrong. Harbor Truth is a fantastic movie with some serious stakes, great performances. Nate Parker is awesome in a supporting role. I mean, this is just a really good movie. Great script.
I can't blame you for it. I mean, that this is one of the movies that I didn't see theatrically, but it did come to us in the mail during award season. And I kept putting – it was one of the first ones that came, and I watched it almost last because I looked at the trailer, and I was like, no. And I could put it down, and then I finally watched it. I was like, damn, I'm glad I actually watched it because it was a really good movie. Same thing with Silver Linings Playbook. One thing I got to eat my words on the review before is I think I made a joke about Chris Tucker. And, you know, when he actually speaks normally and acts normally, I can't say enough good things about Silver Linings Playbook. But Chris Tucker was really surprisingly good in that. I'd like to see him in more stuff if he's acting like that. But that doesn't come out this week, so don't worry about that, guys.
Yeah, it comes out soon. It comes out in a couple weeks, I think.
The Good Doctor, a little-known film with Orlando Bloom, who's still acting, apparently. Californication Season 5. Shameless with Emmy Rossum, who is so hot. And the most important thing coming out Tuesday, Travis, I believe you know what I'm talking about here, is Masters of the Universe 30th Anniversary Commemorative Edition Collection. $89.99. Oh, wait, you know what I just realized? Is this the new one? It looks like the new one.
Okay.
There's a character on the front, and it's an anime He-Man. So I might just
You don't want that.
I might just have to eat my words.
Yeah.
But wait, no, it can't be. It can't be because it's 30th anniversary. Right now, actually Tuesday when it's available, right now through the Punch Drunk Critics store, you can get Masters Universe complete series for $89.99. That's 10% off of the $100 price tag, and you can get it delivered free if you order this week. So check us out there, punchdrunkcritics.com. Click on shop at Punch Drunk Critics and order again.
I heard there's a new She-Ra show coming out soon or something too.
You know, dude, I'm
they're really trying to bring this event
at all the new cartoons because I'm fine with anime. You know, it has its place, but that style of drawing when done to my childhood classics, it gets me all like Thundercats. I was like, oh sweet, turn on Thundercats. It's like Ninja Scroll Thundercats and that just doesn't work for me, so that bothers me. But anyway,
other movies coming out this week.
Also coming out, by the way, Secret of the Other Ninja
Rap. other movies coming out next week on DVD and Blu-ray. Resident Evil Retribution is coming out next week. Not my favorite of the Resident Evil movies. Sleepwalk With Me. This is a fantastic comedy from Mike Biglia, a comedian. Very smart, very insightful about the world of stand-up comedy. When it kind of interferes with your relationships. A very, very good movie. Killer Joe, you saw this, I think.
God,
I did not see Killer Joe yet, but I intend to. That comes out on DVD and Blu-ray next week also.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see what you have to say about it. This is a movie that, it was getting Oscar buzz and all this kind of stuff, and really, it just wasn't that. It's more one of those things where you see the shit on TV, on the screen that... It's like, man, I can't believe that actor did that on screen. Like, I can't believe somebody shot this on screen.
Right.
And people confuse that with doing awards-worthy performances. There is a 30-second brutal scene of Gina Gershon filleting a chicken wing. That is no lie. That is most uncomfortable thing I think I've ever sat through in the theater. the movie's directed by William Friedkin.
More uncomfortable than the first 10 minutes of Zero Dark Thirty?
I haven't seen Zero Dark Thirty yet, but sure that I missed the screenings here, so I'm really pissed about that because everybody's so psyched about that movie. Now I don't get to see it until next week or the week after, I think. But
because they pushed back our release date here into the middle of next month, I think.
Yeah.
So,
but at least Zero Dark Thirty
screen for a little while.
I don't know what that scene entails. I can imagine some kind of torture or something like that. But at least Zero Dark Thirty, it has its ends. Like whatever's happening is happening.
Yeah.
For a reason, to catch the world's foremost villain.
It's deeply unsettling.
But would you say that it's deeply unsettling, but it's there's a reason for it being there?
Well, it has a purpose, yeah. And I'm sure there's a purpose in that Gina Gershon scene, but I'd have to see it before I can...
Not a person.
Kind of
it doesn't warrant the end point, to put that way.
Yeah, all right. Also coming out next week, The Words with Bradley Cooper and Zoe Saldana. Very disappointing movie, in my opinion, as well. Liberal Arts with Josh Radnor and Elizabeth Olsen, and Premium Rush, that other movie that Joseph Gordon-Levitt did this summer, the one that nobody saw,
yeah,
the one where he rides a bike really fast. That's what that
and
movie
that, he's not talking about Angels in the Outfield, people.
No.
He rides a bike very fast in that one, but this is a newer movie.
That's true.
And it wasn't very good.
And Angels in the Outfield is better. Which,
yes.
which should tell you a lot about Premium Rush.
Yes. For some reason, there's a ton of Krav Maga movies coming out. I don't know if it's like Krav Maga Anniversary Week or something, but that's a bunch of that stuff. Gabriel Iglesias, one guy that my in-laws think is hilarious. He's the fluffy comedian guy, but he's funny for like 5 minutes, and then you're just like, all right, dude, shut up. You get it. You like
His humor doesn't do anything for me.
Yeah.
Trailers that came out on the site this week. A lot of great ones, and I want to ask you about a couple of them, because I really don't have any news that struck me this week. There was a lot of news, but nothing major, at least not to me. And you might have a couple things. But trailer-wise, we got a lot. Parker, that's the new film with Jason Statham and Jennifer Lopez. Broken City with Mark Wahlberg and Russell Crowe. Terrible trailer. The first trailer is awesome. This trailer sucked. This one looks like your standard issue Mark Wahlberg movie, which to me is fine, but Broken City should be better than fine. I Give It a Year, this romantic comedy with Rafe Spall and Rose Byrne. It looks promising. I'm So Excited, which is Pedro Almodovar's new film. It looks like it could be a lot of fun. Zero Dark Thirty, the last trailer for that. It's the final trailer for the film. Probably the best trailer for the film also. Very dark stuff going on in this trailer. And you're going to see some of that stuff I was talking about a few minutes ago. In that trailer with Jason Clarke, who I think is the breakout from that movie. As much as I love Jessica Chastain, I think he is the best part of it. Pacific Rim, we've got the first trailer for that. Did you see that trailer for Pacific Rim?
Yes.
What did you think of it?
Honestly, I'm still trying to wrap my head around the whole thing. Half of me wants to love it. I mean, half of me is all in with 2 feet in my swimsuit, but the other part of me thinks that I didn't see enough to really know if I'm just seeing a highlight clip. And then even the visuals, it was kind of like I wasn't sure. I still I honestly have to watch it 2 or 3 more times before I'm really sure, or at least see another trailer, because it doesn't look as good as I thought it would. But I honestly can't give you a full rundown because my head is still. I just watched it this morning. My head is still wrapping around it. But I think it has the potential to be pretty awesome.
Yeah. Excuse me, that's me yawning. That's just me being extremely tired. I really, really dug it. I love the scale of it. I love how I wouldn't think you could put robots of that size on screen, but I guess I should have known that if anybody could, it'd be Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah.
But that's the part of it that really blew me away was the scale of everything going on. I'm still curious to see the finished result. To me, it doesn't look like the effects are quite finished. That's just kind of how it looked to me. It looked a lot like it did at Comic-Con where they showed footage of it, and it looked like a little unfinished. But we'll see. To me, I think this is probably going to be one of the big surprises of next year. It's probably not even really a surprise. I think people are expecting it to do well. Red Band trailer for A Haunted House. This is Marlon Wayans' new film. We actually had an interview with him, so we're going to be playing that soon. As soon as I find out if we're allowed to play it now, we'll have that interview for you. He's actually a really good interview. It doesn't surprise me. It shouldn't surprise me.
He just seems like the kind of guy that's just really cool to talk to, like kind of down to earth still. I mean, it kind of makes sense because when you're a funny guy, you're awesome in your family. But when you're a funny guy and there's 6 other funny guys that had awesome careers before you started, it might be kind of hard, and it probably keeps you leveled.
Well, it was interesting because, I mean, his family has been doing these parodies for a long time, and I tried to focus my interview on that a little bit, was kind of the Wayans lineage. I mean, everybody
was, what, 30 years ago?
And I was talking about Hollywood Shuffle and all this stuff with him, and he said he doesn't feel the pressure, of following in the family line or anything like that, because this is the first film that's like all him, where he wrote it and financed it and all that stuff. So this is a new step for him, and he has a lot of interesting things to say. I got him to talk about G.I. Joe a little bit, which I thought was funny. He talked a lot about Retaliation. G.I. Joe Retaliation, and the interesting way in which he discovered that he was not going to be in the sequel.
Oh man!
So he talked about that a little bit, which was a lot of fun. So he also talked about Scary Movie and his perspective on that franchise, where it's gone. The rest of the movies that have kind of spun off from Scary Movie, like the date movie, you know, all those type things. He's commented on those. So he had a lot of interesting things to say. So we'll have that interview at some point.
You know, I meant to tell you before you went into that interview. I had one question I wanted you to ask, but I completely forgot about it. But I really want to know if Loke Dog from Don't Be a Menace to South Central While Drinking Your Juice in the Hood and Shorty from the Scary Movie franchise are related in some way. They really seem there. But I can't wait to hear this interview, seriously, because Marlon Wayans is a dude, like you said, he's from a family that's – everybody does comedy. It's a family business. And he certainly has done his share of comedy. But if you look at his filmography, he's got – I mean, like, think about it, like Above the Rim, Requiem for a Dream, you know, one of the original indie movies that really got people into it in the last 15 years. To Dungeons & Dragons, an action movie that nobody liked. But
He's branched out to other things. And I did take – I did ask him about all that. So that's in there too. So
cool.
All right, and I have to ask you about Man of Steel. The Man of Steel full trailer came out this week, and I think the internet pretty much blew up. I mean, it was just I have not been blown away. I don't get blown away by trailers like I used to.
Mm-mm.
This trailer blew me away. It was pretty much everything I could have asked for out of a Superman movie without being your typical Superman looking movie at all. It looks like it's going to attack the Man of Steel from a totally different perspective, and in a totally unique way, and in a way that doesn't look like it's Zack Snyder at all, but looks like it's from Christopher Nolan. It's really interesting the way they're doing that. I had a long conversation with our friend Tim Gordon about this trailer, and he was trying to give all the credit to Christopher Nolan, which I won't do, because I think Christopher Nolan has less to do with this movie than people think. But I wanted to give the credit to Zack Snyder for presenting it the way it looks. I don't think he's quite the hack director that people want to label him as. He's not McG.
No.
He's not McG. You know, he's not McG. People want to label him like he's McG because they both make action movies. No, he's not.
Anybody calls Zack Snyder a hack director just is going based on the fact that anytime there's a hyper stylish director or a director with a very visual thumbprint, he gets labeled as a hack. But I mean, I think if you really look at Zack Snyder's movies, they are easy to think, if you're just looking at them, that they're not great movies, but they actually all are. Even 300 had a good story down. If you got to remember, he's the one that made Zombies Run and Dawn of the Dead, and that whole movie that brought him to the forefront was amazing. Watchmen, I know it was too long, and some people was not the superhero movie they thought, but it was a great movie. This Man of Steel, I was actually going to say, it's interesting that they popped Chris Nolan's name on there, because up until this point, you really didn't hear about that much involvement of his. And I really don't think – I think that's just the studios trying to say, hey, you know, if you like Batman, you're going to like this. But I did think it was amazing how a slight like lens filter change, you know, just a different way the light hits the camera can change the entire world they're in. Because, I mean – every Superman movie to this point, Superman Returns, especially in everybody's eyes, it feels like it was shot on one of those cartoon spring mornings where everything's bright and green and skies are blue and flowers are robust. But this one feels almost like an episode. It doesn't feel as dark as the Batman series, but it looked like an episode of Law and Order or something like that. Like you know, kind of the dreary New York streets. And I think I'm blanking on his name. What's the dude's name?
Which one?
Henry
Cavill?
Yeah, Henry Cavill.
Yeah.
Everything we saw before with him looking, ragged like he was on in Les Miserables with his beard and all that, I was like, I don't see it. But then when you see him clean cut and shaven, he doesn't look like Superman. But that's a good thing. He's got the black hair. He's got everything that Superman needs. But he doesn't look like the conventional square-jawed Superman, but that's good because it means we're getting a different Superman completely. And I thought the whole story, I agree with you completely. I haven't been that blown away in a long time to the point where my skin was tingling when I finished watching the trailer. Like I was making sure I was breathing correctly when I was watching. You know, I know most people won't get that, but I'm a super nerd, so that's what I get. I thought it was amazing. It did leave me with one leering question, though. Real quick, before that, Michael Shannon as Zod, I think is probably one of the best Zods I've ever seen, where he's not, he doesn't look like a Wall Street banker. He looks like a warrior. And you only get a quick shot of him, but I love Michael Shannon, too. So, But the only question I have at the end is, how does Superman shave his beard? I mean, you can't cut him with anything, so his hair's got to be just as strong, right?
What do you mean you can't cut him with anything? You can cut his hair.
Kryptonite.
He's not
Gillette.
He's not the Hulk.
Oh, I thought everything was like uncuttable.
No, he's not the Hulk.
I was just joking anyway. That wasn't really a question. It was a question.
And you can cut the Hulk's hair. You just can't penetrate his skin.
Well,
his hair's not made of steel. He's not the man of steel mustache.
Wolf beard. But no, that's just my little joke at the end. But it was amazing. I'm so hyped for it right now. It's not funny.
Yeah. We also got a trailer for The Lone Ranger, the full trailer for that, which I like this trailer. I like this trailer as well compared to the teaser. I think they were aiming a little bit more to be like Pirates of the Caribbean in this trailer than they were in the first one, which was a little bit darker. But all in all, I'm interested in seeing where The Lone Ranger goes. I'm not overly wild about it, but it looks fine. It looks fun.
Mm-hmm. I definitely dug the Welcome to the Punch trailer. I love the crime. I love the look of it. It's dark. One thing, it is a trailer, but it's more the title. I think you know what I'm going to talk about. If anybody's ever seen a sequel to a movie that you were like, why is it a sequel? There's like one thread that goes between the two. It shouldn't be a sequel. Well, I'll give you a little inside trick to Hollywood. Most of the movies you've seen that are sequels were not actually intended, written as sequels. There are other movies that were there. The best example is Blair Witch Project 2. That was actually a totally different movie that they just inserted a couple things and say, okay, now it's Blair Witch 2. And last week we talked about Rise of the Hobbit or Age of the Hobbits. That was actually a movie called like Destination Earth or something like that that they changed to just fit the Hobbits. The reason I talk about all this is the most unsensing title I've ever seen in my life, The Haunting in Connecticut 2, Ghost of Georgia.
Well, you saw my comment in the thread in my post, and I was like, "Really?
What?" You even write the first thing that's the title, which it doesn't make any sense because Haunting in Connecticut wasn't a super blockbuster. So why make your movie sound stupid, just connected to something people didn't really care about in the first place?
Right. But, well, the thing is that I'll give them this. They had this trilogy planned. Okay, the trilogy was planned beforehand. There's going to be the Connecticut, then Georgia, and then New York. And New York is still on the way. They already got the writer for it. So I give them that. And, you know, that's fine. They had the whole thing mapped out. But why call it The Haunting in Connecticut, Ghosts of Georgia?
Yeah, because you're not anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, the original title was The Haunting in Georgia. So why don't you call it that? I mean, so what's the point in trying to latch on to The Haunting in Connecticut? That's not going to draw anybody in.
Yeah.
No, that's not going to do anything. What's the point? I mean, I don't know. To me, it's just silly. And it's almost embarrassing. This will hurt them more, having a nonsensical title like that.
Yeah, you know, it's not. Like, I got a lot of shit from everybody from my gripes over the Transformer Dark of the Moon title that didn't make any sense to me. But this really doesn't make any sense. I mean, unless they're playing the third movie, which you already said is New York, but unless the third movie was The Haunting in Connecticut, Pittsburgh Poltergeist or something like that, where they just wanted to have a rhyme scheme, which is still stupid. There's no way that this makes any sense, and I think somebody should lose their job over this. And I'm the last person to ever say that, but they should.
It's bad. It's bad. It's really bad. So, yeah. And it's a bad trailer. It's not a good trailer either. So it's just overall just terrible.
Well, I mean, you got Chad Michael Murray starring in it. I know people love Katie Sackhoff, but she hasn't done much lately.
She's got Riddick coming up.
Oh, that's right.
She's got Riddick.
She was one of the people that everybody loved, and I finally watched Battlestar, and I was like, all right, I'm down with it. I can see why you guys like her.
She's a tough chick. I mean, she's a tough. I don't even think she's really all that hot. You know, I think she's okay, but tough. Reasonably decent looking chicks always get always get something. They always get people who fall for them, you know. It's just kind of the way it is. That's all the trailers I had that were interesting. Did you have any news that caught your eye? Because I don't really have any.
No, I was kind of on the same page that you were. You know, there's things you guys should check out at the site, like the Spider-Man casting call spoilers and stuff like that. But there's so many trailers. You can spend 2 hours watching the trailers we posted. You got a new G.I. Joe Retaliation trailer. You've got a trailer
with more Channing Tatum.
Yeah,
now with more Channing Tatum.
Ken Watanabe's Japanese Unforgiven remake.
That's what I wanted to ask you about. What did you think of that? Did you watch that trailer?
Yeah, I think it's I think it has everything that I think would be awesome. Because really, there's when it comes to the Old West or that time frame, that there's a reason you always see and not always because it very rarely happens. But if there's ever a cross of cultures in the Old West time frames, it's always Japan and America, like the ninja movie where they came over to here. I forget what it's called.
I think I commented on it when I wrote about it. It's just, you know, we took so many movies from them, you know, like it's like all their samurai movies, we kind of co-opted them and turned them into American Westerns. Mm-hmm. And now, like the movies of Akira Kurosawa, we just pillaged and made them all like Westerns.
Yeah.
You know, Seven Samurai, Magnificent Seven. And this is them kind of doing the same thing to us now, kind of doing the reverse, taking one of our Western classics and making it into a samurai film. And I love the look of it because the samurai and the Western, I mean, they're thematically they're mostly the same.
The only
they're all
no
about
cowboy hat, and you have a sword instead of a gun.
Yeah, you know, you get the same battles. Turn, you know, it's kind of the turn of the age of weaponry and different moral codes are starting to emerge. You know, things like that. Elements like that are universal in these kinds of movies. So I think it looks fantastic. Ken Watanabe is one of my favorite actors. And I think if there's anybody who can kind of take on that Clint Eastwood role perfectly, it's him.
Oh,
so,
yeah, there's no doubt. He is a younger Asian Clint Eastwood to a T. I mean, anything you see this guy in, think of The Last Samurai. Excuse me, The Last Samurai, he really pulls it off like that, you know, head down, quiet talking, speaks softly with a big stick type of guy with morals. You know, that's Ken Watanabe in all his movies. I think he's going to be – I have every expectation up for this one. Other stuff that we don't really have to talk about, but it's probably worth mentioning, is the After Earth trailer with Will and Jaden Smith.
Yeah.
Jet Li's new trailer for The Sorcerer and the White Snake. It's not too often that we have two awesome-looking martial artsy type trailers up on the site at one time. And Tom Cruise's Oblivion, which I must need to get back up on my news because I didn't even know this movie was in production.
Yeah, he's actually got like 3 or 4 sci-fi movies coming out in like the next 2 years, and this is the first one. It's directed by Joseph Kaczynski, who did Tron Legacy. So, I mean, it looks really good. It looks solid. So I'm anxious to see how that one pans out next year. All right, next week. I don't know what you want to do for next week because I'm not going to be here next weekend. In fact, I'm leaving on Saturday. So I don't know if you want to bring in a guest to host or not. But we got some big movies coming out next week. Jack Reacher, This Is 40, Judd Apatow's new film, The Impossible with Naomi Watts and Ewan McGregor, and also Rust and Bone, which I'm sure everybody knows by now is my favorite movie of the year. So I'm kind of sad I won't be here to talk about it, but I've talked about it enough for the last 2 months.
Well,
I mean, I don't know if you want to bring in, call in a pinch hitter like Rocky or somebody else to come in and fill my shoes. We'll see what happens for next week. But
I'd like to almost, if you have time, just to reschedule before or something like that, because I really don't want to do Rust and Bone without you here. Because that's, ever since Virginia Film Festival, been hearing you talk about it, and then I saw it when we were getting our screeners, and I really would like to do that all together if we can. If not, then we'll
well, maybe we can move the show to Friday because I leave on Saturday, so maybe we can do the show on Friday, and then we can just do that. Maybe that'll be what we do.
Yeah,
and maybe I'll ask Rocky to still come in and be on the show anyway next week, or we can hold her off for 2 weeks from now when we do our best ofs.
Right.
Because I'd kind of like, and I know I've talked to some other critics about coming in and joining us, but there's a part of me that wants to have that show, because I don't know how many more I'll be on after that.
Mm.
There's a part of me that wants to have like all four punch drunk critics in there for that show.
Yeah, definitely. That'd be, we could even just do like you and me talking about Rust and Bone by itself in an earlier day, and then I can mix it in with the show later. So we'll talk about that off air.
We'll figure it out. That's behind the scenes.
But we will have a show next week in some way, shape, or form, so you guys can get the all your reviews for all those big movies coming out. Some big things to check out on the site. Right now there is a new screening contest up for Jack Reacher, the new Tom Cruise movie, coming out this Friday. You'll get to see it on Wednesday. Just go to punchdrunkcritics.com, check that out. You remember all your last-second Christmas shopping, you can do punchdrunkcritics.com, click on Shop, Punch Drunk Critics. You can still get that stuff in. Plenty of time to wrap it. And apparently, as Travis said, they'll wrap it for you. So there's that as well. Another good reason to check out the site this week is we are going to be doing installments from all four of the Punch Drunk Critics about our different top tens of the year. I'll be leading it off tomorrow with action films, and then what else do we have going on? I just said that. There we go. Tuesday, Julian's going to be bringing his top ten genre movies, you know, whatever he chooses to talk about. Rocky, I'm going to read her actual suggestion. Wednesday's going to be Rocky and Best Kisses or Nudity or something. So make sure to check that out. Thursday, Travis is bringing his Best Overlooked Films. And Friday, we're all going to be bringing our top five of the year lists to you. So check those out every single day, punchdrunkcritics.com. On Facebook, we are Punch Drunk Critics. Search us, like us. Why wouldn't you? If you have any questions, comments, concerns, or just want to talk, send us an email at punchdrunkcritics or Gmail or at yahoo.com. I don't know why I always say just want to talk. I'm not your therapist. Don't do that. You people did last message. It wasn't funny. I don't care about what's growing down there. And I don't think there's anything else. That is it.
No, I think that is it. I do want to thank everybody who read my top 10 Examiner list, my best movies. I got some nice feedback on it, and it's doing very well. So I appreciate everybody who read that. If you haven't read it yet, go to examiner.com and just type in Travis Opson. Not that hard. You'll find me there. So I do appreciate that, and I'll be putting it up on Punch Drunk Critics at some point. But since we're doing our own lists, there's no rush.
Yeah, we should almost put like a feed to all your Examiner stuff over there, so we can check that out there too. Yeah, so next week we'll see you guys then, and then make sure to tune in 2 weeks from now for our epic last regular installment of Punch Drunk Critics Live. Of our top movies. We'll try to have everybody in here. It'll be like the Cheers finale when we'll bring back all the guest stars. And Travis will marry the waitress and leave. make sure to come back for that. And if something happens and we don't talk to you until after Christmas, everybody have a Merry Christmas. Safe, happy holidays. To everybody celebrating Hanukkah, happy holidays to you. I know that's already passed or is almost there. And whatever you celebrate, even if you don't celebrate anything, it's a good time to be happy this year. So we will talk to you guys later. Check us out every day, punchdrunkcritics.com. And I'm going to keep saying stuff if I don't just shut up. So I guess we're out.
We're out. Later.
And just one more time for shits and giggles. Oh, I hit the wrong thing. Where'd it go? Oh, don't do it.
Duh.
We came, we saw, we kicked its ass.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
I'm not great at farewell, so, that'll do, pig.
That's the worst goodbye I've ever heard. And you stole it from a movie.